This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 15th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 435. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, the February 10th Tumbler Ridge tragedy, a mass shooting that shocked Canada and the world. My guest, Sarah Peck, is director of United on Guns and co-author of the Mass Shooting Protocol and Playbook. She explains the three phases of a mass shooting. Plus, British Columbia lost beloved sports broadcasting legend Jim Robson, who died at the age of 91. One of Jim Robson's many disciples, Sports Talk's Dan Russell, joins me to remember the original voice of the Vancouver Canucks. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
But I, the leader of the opposition, the leader of all the federal parties, wanted you to hear, not from Ottawa, not through a screen, but standing here together in your home, we wanted you to hear the Canadians are with you.
We are all today Tumbler Ridge strong. The Prime Minister spoke of grace, and indeed, Prime Minister, you have shown tremendous grace in bringing together the leaders of all political parties and flying us here together as one. We all lead political parties, but today there are no conservatives. There are no liberals, New Democrats, Greens, or Bloc Québécois.
The pain we carry is real. The loss is profound. And the days ahead will not be easy. Grief does not end when this vigil ends. It takes time. It takes patience. And it takes care for one another. But if tonight has shown us anything, it is that we are not alone. We are neighbors. We are friends. We are classmates. And we are colleagues. We are family.
Prime Minister Mark Carney, Opposition Leader Pierre Poilievre, and Tumbler Ridge Mayor Daryl Krakowka at the February 13th Candlelight Vigil. 3 days after the second worst school shooting in Canadian history since École Polytechnique in Montreal in 1989. These are highlights of how the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in British Columbia communicated about the Tumbler Ridge mass shooting. North District Commander Ken Floyd, then BC Deputy Commissioner Dwayne McDonald.
So we have 9 total people deceased. We found 8 in Tumbler Ridge in 2 locations, and then another was deceased during ambulatory transport to the clinic.
Okay, and none of those people are the gun person?
That includes the deceased gun person.
Okay, and then separately, do you know the gun person's relationship to the school?
Not at this time, no.
The suspect has been identified as 18-year-old Jesse Van Rootselaar, who is a resident of Tumbler Ridge. 2 firearms, a long gun and a modified handgun, were recovered by responding officers. Determining the origin of these firearms and what role they played in the shootings remains a significant part of the active and ongoing investigation. Multiple victims were located throughout the school, along with approximately 25 individuals with possible injuries. Once it was determined to be safe, officers evacuated over 100 students and faculty to a local community center, while police continued to assess whether any ongoing threats remained. Those with potential injuries were transported to the local medical clinic for triage and assessment, and 2 victims with significant injuries were transported to hospital via air ambulance. Following a medical assessment of the individuals, no discernible physical injuries were identified for those that remained at scene. I will say this, we identified the suspect as they chose to be identified in public and in social media. I can say that Jesse was born as a biological male who approximately, the information that I have, approximately 60 years ago began to transition to female and identified as female, both socially and publicly. While public focus remains on honoring the victims, images of the suspect are also being shared online. However, some coverage and posts have included images of an unrelated person, which has resulted in false accusations. The BCRCMP is sharing a confirmed image of our suspect, Jesse Van Rootselaar, and is urging the public and the media to use verified information and to confirm the accuracy of your images. We would also like to advise that an individual in Ontario with a similar name to the person associated with our incident has been wrongly accused of being responsible. Xylee, this did not need to happen. We know you are not involved. The significant public attention to the incident in Tubman Ridge has resulted in heightened concern in many communities across our country. We are mindful that public and media response and coverage can increase false reports, but can also bring forward serious complaints. The RCMP remains vigilant, and police are reviewing any and all threats, including those that may involve schools, to ensure safety.
In the aftermath of the February 10th mass shooting in Tumba Ridge, British Columbia, 8 people plus the shooter are dead, and there are others that are struggling with their lives in hospital. And joining me to talk about mass shootings and what can be done about mass shootings is Sarah Peck, who's director of United on Guns with the Public Health Advocacy Institute in the United States. Now, Sarah authored the Mass Shooting Protocol and Playbook. It's a resource for U.S. mayors and city managers, but it could also now be more useful than ever for Canadian public bodies. What is the Public Health Advocacy Institute? And what is the United on Guns project?
And the Public Health Advocacy Institute is established at Northeastern University School of Law in Boston. And they pioneered the litigation that was used in the tobacco cases long ago to help elected officials hold corporate entities to account for the health damages created by their products. That was a long time ago. Right now, they still work on tobacco-related cases and policy, but they also look at other public health issues. And when I had the opportunity to meet up with them and talk to them about my interest in the devastating impact of mass shootings and gun violence, I pointed out it was a public health issue, and they agreed. So they adopted me as their initiative on gun violence. And so what I set out to do is figure out, what could we do that would actually impact public health, that would be useful and wasn't duplicating the effort of other organizations? And I had the opportunity to talk to Mayor Bill Peduto of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who had responded to the Tree of Life synagogue shooting about a year before. And I asked him, what did he need on that day, that terrible day that he didn't have? And he said, I could have used a protocol to help me understand what my role as an elected official was. And that's what got us started. We all understand what law enforcement is supposed to do, and we'll talk more about that. But what are mayors, city councilors, other elected and appointed officials supposed to be doing, both before something like this happens, during, and after? And it turns out a lot. They are on the they are responsible for ensuring that everything is working properly and looking out for the long-term recovery of the victims, the family members, and the community, which can and does go on for years. It's a lot. So that's what we did. We conducted research interviewing the officials of 6 mass shootings in the United States. We chose within a time frame to ensure that they were recent and that they used the best practices and the best technology that was available at the time, and that were also large enough that you could see the full range of services and response techniques that were used in those incidents. And we did not consult with political groups. This was a nonpartisan, public health-focused interview project that was approved by the university and used those techniques to ensure that it was appropriate for the interviews of the people who had to participate, and that would also be scientifically based. And we created the resources that you mentioned, the protocol, which is that thing that Mayor Peduto asked for, which is a very short document. It's 4 pages long. It's filled with, it has a checklist and filled with the actions that must be taken in the early hours following a mass shooting or other incident of mass violence. And those are things that really need to be done either by those elected officials or somebody. And these are not the law enforcement actions. So they are establishing the victim services. They're thinking about how the fundraising will be managed and handled. It's starting to plan for the long-term recovery. It's thinking about crisis communications and what should be said and what shouldn't be said. So, and how you're going to engage with emergency managers and law enforcement. So that's it's the break glass now, it's happening. That's the tool that you can use if you're an elected official. Often they don't have that at first. So it's actually helpful to, after the event, to go back and make sure that you've done everything that needed to be done. But then the bigger resources, the mass shooting playbook, it's 200 pages. It's divided into the chapters focus on the areas where elected officials should be focusing their energy and their planning. And each of those chapters is divided into the preparedness part, which of course, if it's already happened, that's for a later time or for, to get out ahead of these things, but mainly for the immediate response and then planning for the long-term recovery. So I really don't want to talk specifically about this particular incident. It's so fresh. It's so awful. It's still happening. But for any big incident, this tool is one that can be used over weeks, over months, even over years.
The playbook is divided into 9 chapters, goes from crisis communications, the first chapter, all the way to mental health, the last chapter. And you talk about the phases, preparedness, response, and recovery. Now, that crisis communications part, I mean, that's as things are unfolding, as facts are being discovered. The recommendation is to communicate early and often and release facts as they are confirmed.
That's right. And it's what is early enough? As early as possible, as soon as, and there's different strategies to this. I've spoken to a lot of mayors and communications experts who talk about this. Sometimes if the assailant hasn't been apprehended yet, for example, the first messaging may come from law enforcement, and what they will say is that they will issue emergency alerts, letting people know that they need to shelter in place or that they need to be on the lookout for certain vehicles or other indicators that will help them solve the case or find the assailant and thereby keep the rest of the community secure. But as soon as, and it's usually within a couple of hours, you're going to want to have a plan how you're going to communicate the messaging so that you have the law enforcement officials, you have the public leaders, usually the mayor or the city councilor or whoever is the senior representative of the community, because they are the face of the community. They do need to be represented there and they should speak. And then you'll usually have the different parts of law enforcement or first responders speak. You'll often have fire as well as police or if FBI in the U.S. If there's other in your case the Royal Canadian Police, there may be different branches who are involved, and so they may say different things. But you're right. As soon as possible, get out in front of this. And then continue to let the press know when the next one will be. And even if you don't have new information, you at least show up, you answer questions that are appropriate, you have in place a plan for coordinating so that you are communicating accurate information, and you have a plan for how you're going to alert the public through social media. So you have a city website or you have the police website, you direct people to that website so that they always have the up-to-the-minute information about the incident. And this is what you need to do to counter misinformation and to try to reduce the amount of politicization that can happen in the response to an incident.
An even bigger risk these days is the misinformation and disinformation finding its way into those gaps, and also the politicization. We saw that unfold here in Canada, in British Columbia with this incident. There was one first briefing by a senior RCMP officer in a regional headquarters, but not actually in Tumbler Ridge. And then the next morning there was at the provincial headquarters, a briefing by the most senior RCMP officer in the province, but it didn't have that unified approach of all officials at the same time. And the message also didn't seem to be unified, because there was also information gaps about the shooter, the perpetrator of all this. There is the hunger for information from the public, and it led to the public doing a lot of its own research on the fly to fill in the spaces that the officials could have filled in almost immediately.
Well, I don't want to Monday morning quarterback this particular communication, but I do want to say in a general sense that it is very chaotic when something like this happens. And so it's really great to have a plan in advance before anything happens, and you can, if you're an official listening to this, you can go to our crisis communications chapter and learn from some of the best in the world who have either responded to a mass shooting or are crisis communications experts who've advised us on this chapter. But if it's already happened, there's nothing like the people who are involved in the incident, not somebody somewhere else, but who are there on the ground, who know the facts, forming a strategy immediately and executing on that strategy. And that's a good practice.
We've seen the American experience that this is not something that is restricted to major cities. Often happens in suburbs, often happens in small towns. There's no community, big or small, that's immune from these. Is that something that also needs to be better communicated to public officials, even smaller centers? They need to be better prepared.
Absolutely excellent point to make, because most mass shootings, at least in the United States, and we can extrapolate to Canada as well, do take place in smaller communities. They are often take place in workplaces or in schools, which are not in major cities. Major cities have huge police forces and resources, so incidents do happen there. But if you look at all the shootings that have happened in the U.S., they really do take place in smaller communities. And so you have to think about, how would we respond? What resources do we have to draw on if this would happen in our community? Because it really could. Some of the things that would be helpful to think about in advance would be, first of all, ensuring you know who the law enforcement officials are going to be that are going to respond. Do you have, I mean, in the case of Parkland, Florida, they did not have their own police force. They had to rely on the sheriff department and a neighboring community police force. So if you're relying on someone who you don't work with every day, you don't know, you need to find out what kind of training do they have. Are they prepared? Do they have the right equipment? Do you have a contact with them? Do you know who they're going to be? So, you know, thinking through who the responders are going to be. Then the next part is, and this is true of most of the United States and true probably of most of Canada, is that the nearest trauma center may be very far away. How are you going to provide emergency stabilizing care in the early minutes, the golden minutes, where you have to, you know, you have to use tourniquets, you have to use techniques that can help stabilize an injured person long enough to be able to get to the stages of medical care that they're going to need, first to a local medical center where they can be further medically stabilized, and then transported to a trauma center if that's what they need. So these are things that are really helpful to think about in advance, especially if you're in a trauma center desert where there isn't one nearby. How are you going to manage that? For elected officials, one of the most important roles is the victim services. law enforcement and fire. That's the response, you know, to neutralize the threat. But for the elected officials, it's being there to provide the support to the family members. And that includes, how are you going to deliver death notifications? That's an area where you can really traumatize people by withholding information that you know, but you're not revealing yet, or the way that you deliver that information. It really matters a lot. Where are they going to go? What services are you going to offer them? In some large incidents, I look at the Orlando shooting, the Pulse shooting. It was a huge incident, and there were hundreds of people impacted who needed all kinds of services, travel services, pet care services, babysitting services. They needed to be fed. These are just practical things that require building community partnerships and thinking through a bit in advance what kind of mental health care providers do we have in this area? Do they have the right kind of training? Who will we call? How will we pull this all together? And where will they go? One of the things that they've done in Nashville, and I'd like to talk more about Nashville and the Covenant school shooting, because they really are a best practice in school shootings, and there's a lot of information in our playbook about it. And since this is a school, I don't want to talk about this particular school, but when we're talking about school shootings, there are things that you can think about in advance. And one of them is, for every single school, know where the family resource center, the place where you will reunify families, where is that for every school? So that it's just known, you know which partners are going to draw on, you know how you're going to secure it, you know that there's parking there, you know how you're going to communicate that to friends and family so they know where to go. So those are the kinds of things that, if you are a small community, large too, but especially if you're a small community, you can get out ahead of this. It could be even a natural disaster that's happening. Could be flooding, could be river flooding. We saw that in Texas last year. Could be hurricanes or tornadoes. All of these sudden extreme emergencies require being able to support family members and the injured, you know, the people who are injured or deceased. And this is the kind of thing that you can think about in advance, and our resources can help you, even if you're not in the United States.
You talked about Nashville being a best practice. What is the top one, two, or three gaps? And since PHAI has been looking at this phenomenon, and are they being filled when it comes to preparation?
The case of Nashville is interesting for a number of reasons. It's interesting to us because they actually used our resources during the response to the Covenant school shooting. And so we were able to interview the officials who used those resources to understand what was useful and how they used them, because we just did a complete rewrite of or update, I should say, of our resources to incorporate all of these best practices and the things that we've learned from other cities over the past 5 years since we published the first version. Going back to the beginning, we wanted to include a school shooting because this is obviously something that unfortunately happens. And our first case history was the Parkland school shooting. And you can see case briefs on our website. You can read about what happened there. And it was a case where, as I mentioned before, they did not have their own police force. They had to rely on the sheriff and the police from a neighboring community. But the response was flawed. And there's been a lot of reporting and the law enforcement response was flawed. Police officer or sheriff officers did not enter the building. They stood outside. There was a school resource officer who stood and hid and did not go inside the building. And that delay, arguably, many argue, the prompt response, let's put it in the inverse, might have saved lives. we will never know, right? But the point here is that we really are asking law enforcement officials to risk their lives to save other people. That is the job. But if we're going to ask them to do something that is essentially a battlefield kind of situation, they need to have proper training. It's active violence incident training. And they need to have proper vests. They need to have the right kind of firearms. They need to have the techniques that will save their lives. And in the United States, there are organizations that provide that kind of training. And I don't know about what's done in Canada, but we do have best practices in the US. And that is something that the commanders of those units should be looking at. Are we providing that training for our officers? Because they deserve it. They need it in order to do their job. They can't be asked to go in and save lives if they fear for their own lives. So that was what happened in Parkland. There were some really good best practices from that. The compassion and leadership of the mayor, it really illustrates how important the leadership of the elected officials are in a school shooting. But to the point of Nashville, there was another school shooting in between, and that was the Uvalde shooting. That one made international news because for over an hour, the local police, they had over, I believe they had maybe, I may have the numbers wrong, as many as 300 officials from Border Patrol to prison guards to the school police and the local police and probably state Texas State Police were all there. But if you don't have a plan to first coordinate all of them and make sure they're all doing something positive, then you're going to start having problems, which they had. They blocked roads so that helicopters and ambulances couldn't even get to the school. Tragic. Planning will prevent that. But the officers were inside the building and never breached the door and confronted the shooter. And so he went on shooting for over an hour until finally other officers who felt confident that they had the skills to go in pushed them aside and went in and killed the shooter. We can't have that. We cannot have that. The officers need to be prepared to confront the shooter if it happens in a community. So when this happened, first of all, I say that's the job now of elected officials is to make sure they know who's going to be responding that happens and that they have the proper training and equipment. It costs money. It requires time for those officers to receive that training. You in the U.S. that you can get that training for free. I don't know how it works in Canada, but it is a question to think about. And I can refer you to, well, our resources can refer you to the people who can inform on those questions. But going now to Nashville, what happened was after the Uvalde shooting, Chief Drake, who leads the Nashville Regional Police, said that is not, if we have a school shooting here, that is not happening. We will be prepared. And through the city's in-house training program, they made sure that every officer from the first police recruits coming in all the way to him, the chief himself, all have that active violence incident training. They had the right equipment, and they knew that even if it was one officer there arriving first at the scene, if there was a school shooting, they would go in. And that is exactly what they did. They were prepared. And the first officer who responded went in. And so they responded, neutralized the shooter within minutes. That is what we're looking for. But they had done other things. As I said, they had already assigned a family center where people would be reunited with their children for every single school in the district. They had badge wave-in ability so that you don't need to run around looking for keys to get into buildings. They had that. They had bulletproof glass for the schools in the district. They had done a stop the bleed training and other training with school officials throughout the district. Chief Drake says that the reason why so few people were killed in that incident, and even one is too many, of course, but in that incident, the teachers and the principals were trained, prepared, ready to go. When it happened, they knew how to get the children locked behind doors and out of stairwells and in a secure place so that they would be safe. So these are things that are very clearly outlined in the playbook. These are the best practices of people who really are professionals, who we've seen it in action, and we know that it works.
In the third and final phase of the playbook is recovery. Tumblr Ridge is in that recovery phase. It's early days, but this recovery is going to take weeks, months, probably years. What are the most important things for people in Tumblr Ridge to know, and other cities that and towns that need to prepare for this? The recovery phase. What does that entail?
First of all, I want to say one word, and that is compassion. Everyone should be exercising compassion. This is a terrible thing. This is a terrible thing for everyone. And this is not the time to be pointing to your political beliefs or anything else. This is how are we going to get through this together? That is what everybody needs to be focused on. How can they help? How can they support? Can they donate blood? If they're going to contribute funding, what is the official funding source so that it all goes through the process? And by the way, we have a lot of information about best practices for managing a victim's fund. The families and the victims are going to need a lot of grace. Their healing will take place in different ways over time. And there are a lot of resources in our playbook that are just basic concepts. So if you are in a role where you are supporting those families, there's information to help you understand and resources that are, I think, universally applicable that can help. But let's not forget the first responders. This is a devastating thing to experience, and first responders also need care. That they need to be taken probably out of their assignments for the short term. And again, I don't want to talk about this particular incident, but you know, generally speaking, we have a lot of information about resources and care and support for the first responders, both the ones who responded and were there, but also the ones that weren't there and are also, you know, hypothetically speaking, could also be struggling with not having been there, to not be there to support. So that's an important thing to think about. There will be memorials. There will be all kinds of events and things. There's ways to think about doing them in a way that is healing for the community. Well, and it's a long recovery.
Long recovery indeed, and very useful information that you've provided. Sarah Peck, Director of United on Guns with the Public Health Advocacy Institute, thank you for joining me on the podcast. Where can people find out more information about United on Guns, as well as the playbook and the protocol?
They can go to our website, which is unitedonguns.org. And I'd like to encourage elected officials and both at the national and the local level to take a look, to look at especially the preparedness resources that we have there. But I also invite the press and advocates and family members to review the resources so that they can hold their elected officials accountable. You know, are they doing the things they need in advance so that as many lives can be saved as possible should an incident happen in their community? And so I think informing yourself, especially the school chapter, does a lot to explain what parents might be wanting to think about for the school if their children are in school. But it's important to understand what your elected officials should be doing so that you can ask them about it and hold them to account to make sure that they do those things in advance.
beloved Jim Robson, British Columbia's most listened to voice and most trusted voice. He passed away at age 91 on February 10th. Jim Robson called the very first Canucks game on Hockey Night in Canada back in 1970, and best known for his career with CKNW as the Canucks radio play-by-play man.
Highlights from the January 2018 ceremony when the city of Maple Ridge dedicated a street to Maple Ridge Rays Jim Robson.
I've always admired hockey players a great deal. They play a really tough game. There's no out of bounds, and they play with skill, courage, and character. And that's the way to describe every hockey player, even these little guys in their wrestler sweaters. It's a tremendous game, and it takes an awful lot to play it well. So we've been very fortunate. I traveled a lot. As hockey players know, you're on the road, those 14 and 15 game trips in the East. So family was back home and very important, but never got enough attention. But we're getting too much attention here tonight. It's really special for me, and I appreciate it very much. I'd just like to thank everybody in the room for being here, and it's really something to hear all that praise from people that I certainly admire and will continue to admire. Thank you all very much.
The Pride of Maple Ridge retired in 1999, and his name is on the broadcast gondola at Rogers Arena. He really is someone who embodied the best of British Columbia. For 30 years, Dan Russell informed and entertained British Columbia sports fans on Sports Talk, the longest running show of its type on Canadian radio. He's a 2023 inductee to the BC Sports Hall of Fame. Now, Vin Scully was a major influence on Dan Russell, but so was Jim Robson. Dan Russell joining me from Thailand.
Yes.
Dan, what went through your mind when you heard that we lost Jim Robson?
I can't believe it hit me this hard because he lived such a long, good life, and he had a very short illness at the end, from what I understand. But this hit hard, and it hit hard for all of us in the media. I had four idols / mentors, and they're all gone now. Jim Robson, Larry King, a gentleman you knew, and Al Jordan, and Vin Scully. So those four, I learned an awful lot from. But Jim Robson was the first. I've told this story many times. On Christmas Day 1968 is when I got my first radio, and the Canucks happened to be playing a game on Christmas night in Portland. And when my dad tucked me in, he said, "You can listen on your new radio to a hockey game." It was all new to me. And on that night, I befriended Jim Robson, although he didn't know it, and the sport of hockey at the same time. And then the years went by. I know by age 12, I got an autograph, and that was such a huge thrill. When they entered the NHL, I listened to literally every game, took notes, stats, everything, for almost 30 years, like the whole time, but certainly really intense the first 20 years. So I wouldn't miss it. And I'm talking all three periods. I mean, I was a huge listener, and so much of my career was shaped because of him, and I wanted to be him. And you know, I did this talk show, which was highly successful, as you identified, and thank you for those words. But for much of that, I was in my mind thinking, I hope I can parlay this talk show into one day having the opportunity to maybe replace Jim Robson when he retired. Turned out that didn't happen, although I did reach my dream of calling some NHL games, which was fantastic for me. But, you know, and my talk show was great, and a great thing for my career. And then I did a lot of Western Hockey League play-by-play. But it hit hard, Bob, because he meant so much to everybody, and he made us all feel good. I've been really warmed by all the tributes in the social media. Everybody seems to have a story as to how Jim touched them, how Jim Robson made them feel so special. And it was like, you know, royalty when you went by him. And if you got praise from him, it was like, oh my goodness, this is just awesome. So, you know, a lot of words have been said, and they're all deserving, but it hits me hard because I just feel like I've known him all my life.
What was the quality that made him such a successful broadcaster such a compelling voice on the radio, conveying the Canucks history moment by moment as it unfolded before our eyes and ears?
Well, luckily for us, he had a lot of experience before the Canucks came into the NHL. He did many years of the Western Hockey League, the Pro Hockey League back then, and of course the BC Lions, and he did all of his Mounties baseball. So he had so much on-air experience, and it's, you know, it's fun. I've never obviously been a pilot, but they talk about the in-the-air hours that a pilot has to have for great experience. Well, the on-the-air hours give you also great experience. The only reason I was able to develop as fast as I did is because I had 3 hours a night. I was constantly on the air, 5 nights a week. Well, you get better. Well, Jim Robson got better. And then once the Canucks hit the NHL, he was this great at play-by-play broadcaster. I'm biased, but everybody's saying it, and probably the greatest hockey radio play-by-play guy ever. And what made him so good? A few qualities. His anticipation was off the charts. I mean, you could feel the build-up, and he had those cadences. But I think what made him so good, and I know this because I went on to try to do play-by-play, and I remember when I first started doing mock tapes, I even went out to the Coliseum and did it, and I would record Jim Robson, and then I'd compare mine later to what the real great guy, how he called it. And I couldn't believe how many words I was saying and how few words he was saying. His word economy, his editing on the fly, being able to judge what was important and what wasn't. Let's face it, hockey's going a million miles an hour. You can call everything if you wanted to, but he called the pertinent stuff, and he seemed to get that always right. So he edited on the fly. He was able to build it up. He was true to his audience. He never faked the excitement. If the game was ragged, he'll tell you it's ragged. The play is pretty dull right now. And then as it picked up, you could feel it picking up. And so he just gave you that feel. I'll many times told people I would rather listen to any Jim Robson game than watch it on TV if the choice is that.
But do you think that baseball is what prepared him for that other world of hockey?
I don't know, but I do know one thing is that when you get the skill of calling play-by-play, so much of it is just robotic at some point. Pucks down in the left corner, they move it over to the right corner, it comes back to, you know, left wing, right wing, you're just calling it. And if you're good at it, it really sounds good. Baseball, like you say, you've got to, between pitches, you have to have, you know, material. You have to have a story. I mean, nobody was like Vin Scully that way. And he was able to storytell through the whole broadcast and give you the play-by-play at the same time. So I don't know. I think it goes back to what I said earlier about the on-air hours. Baseball gave him so many on-air hours. And how about, Bob, all those reconstructions? How did he do that? Mm-hmm. How did he reconstruct baseball? And he had a great producer. And some people say, oh, he hit, you know, they had a pencil and they knocked it against a piece of wood. No, they had all the authentic sound effects, but he would be sitting there on Burrard Street in the CKWX studios, and he would be calling a game that was actually being played in Portland or in Salt Lake or wherever the heck they happen to be. I think that was a major skill set. And you know what? I've heard a couple clips of him doing that, but I was just too young to catch that. So I never really heard Jim Robson do reconstructed baseball, but I'm told he was great. I had him on one of my Journey series. He did lacrosse as reconstruction during Man Cup. How do you reconstruct a lacrosse game? And he was telling the story about, you know, they had a box score, and I think it was the Nanaimo team that was back east or something. And he's got the box score, and the leading scorer isn't on he's in the lineup, but he hasn't hit the score sheet. And, you know, those games are 18, 16 or whatever they are. And he told the story on my show that, his wife had called the next day because somebody said, why wasn't he on the score sheet? Well, the wife said he got hurt in the first 5 minutes of the game. Well, nobody told Jim that. He still had him in the game.
Did you ever ask Jim for advice?
Oh, yeah, because I wanted his job. And the first time I asked him that, I was 16 years old working at the Kolchina Golf Club in the kitchen. There was a pro-am event, and I met him, and I went out. I had the courage to go out and meet him, and I said, one day I want your job. He said, stand in line. Okay, there's going to be a lot of people like that. You know, he, another time I met him, oh, I got his autograph at age 12, and then I met him at the Kolchina Club, and about 3 years later, I'm volunteering now, doing hockey broadcasts on community television. And there was a tournament, I don't know if you remember, a tournament called the Max Midget Tournament, and it was played in Delta. And somehow, the gentleman who was organizing knew Jim Robson and convinced Jim Robson to come out. Well, imagine this. I'm the play-by-play guy, and there's like six games in a day, and we're doing all six. And they asked Jim Robson if he would sit in the broadcast, if he would call a game. And Jim said, no, 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 but I'll do color. So I'm broadcasting with Jim Robson as my color guy, and I'm like 20 years, I mean, I'm pinching myself. So then years later, as it became apparent that one day he would retire, I was really trying to focus in on in hoping to at least have a good shot at becoming his replacement. And one day he invited me to his home. Well, I was at his home a number of times, but one day I had a tape and he listened to the whole thing. He was taking notes. You know, you've heard this story from other people too, but you know, he just couldn't have been nicer about it. But then he often said this to me, and he knew that I wanted to go into play-by-play, and he kept saying, why would you give up your talk show? And I said, well, I didn't grow up with my talk show. I grew up with you, and this talk show evolved and became great, and I'm so thankful for it. But he really questioned me many times as to why would I even want to pursue that job when you already had the sports talk going.
And what is his legacy?
Everything in the sports media Vancouver. He's on the Mount Rushmore. I mean, let's start with all-time popular Vancouver Canucks. And by that, we have to include players, management, coaches, and broadcaster. Well, I would argue even now that list, if you had a list of five and put them in any order you want, Jim Robson's going to be on that list with Pat Quinn and Pavel Bure and Trevor Linden and Stan Smith. I'll just throw those five out. But whoever you want to replace on that list, you can't replace Jim Robson. He was the star of the Vancouver. Now, he'd hate hearing that, of the Vancouver, especially in the first 10, 15 years. And remember, we only had a total of maybe the first 3 or 4 years, we would have maybe six games on television out of 80. Okay, so 75 times a year, the only way you could consume the Canucks is by listening to Jim Robson on the radio. That became some midweek games a few years later, but even then, there wasn't that many. So the first decade, the first 15 years, he was our standout in British Columbia. And so I, you know, being in New York in 94, and I'll never forget, my feeling was, yeah, I'm trying to do a neutral show as best I can based in Vancouver, but my bias tonight is, wow, I hope they win for a few reasons, but two of them were Jim Robson and Pat Quinn. You just hope that somehow they would enjoy the moment of the Canucks reaching the top of the mountain and winning. I to this day remain heartbroken that he never got the call of Vancouver Canucks Stanley Cup. But in exchange, we got Jim for all those years, and how lucky we were, because I can tell you, having been in so many of the markets and being pretty much an expert in this topic, we had the best. I mean, there's other good ones around, but Jim Robson, and I especially mean radio, but he was very good on television too. But his radio calls, second to none.
And while I got you here, I wanted to ask you some quick hits about some headlines in sports here in Vancouver in the Pacific Northwest. Leading off with the Seahawks winning their second Super Bowl over the New England Patriots. And of course, we saw those great images out of Seattle of the massive victory parade. The Seattle city officials estimated there could have been 1 million people in downtown Seattle to celebrate on that blue sky day from Lumen Field to the Space Needle. What are your thoughts on the 2025-2026 edition of the Seattle Seahawks?
Amazing. Just amazing. And, you know, all year long watching these games, I'm wondering, you know, are they for real? Are they that good? I mean, when they were, you know, about two-thirds of the way through, they were winning a few games where I'm thinking, man, how are they pulling that out? And is that going to be something that will bite them? Because they, I can't remember the specific games off the top of my head, but there was like two or three where they just kind of pulled it out, and they weren't especially great, but they were good, and they did, and they just kept winning and winning. But I remember saying during those few games to a few friends that I had over here watching, I said, I don't know if they can win at all, because they seem to have a little bit of an offensive Achilles heel, but they got that going, and then they kept rolling and rolling. And what a defensive gem the Super Bowl was. I mean, we can watch many more Super Bowls and never see a team dominate that much defensively.
And then the opposite end of the scale here in Vancouver, the Canucks tanking in 2026. They might get a first-round draft pick. Maybe they'll win the draft lottery, but we're still a long way from having our own victory parade here in Vancouver.
You say a long way? Or, I mean, that's an understatement. I mean, I can't believe that. I mean, where do you want to start? I mean, ownership is obviously a big problem in Vancouver. I mean, this owner has just not been able to hire the right people to make the right decisions. We've got a 77-year-old team president now who's in the Hall of Fame, and rightfully so, but did not sign in for this rebuild. There's no way he came here thinking, oh, yeah, a few years in, we're going to be at that complete bottom. He's made a lot of questionable moves. His coach was that the whole coaching situation going back to Cockett, you know, how they didn't re-sign him after he wins coach of the year, then he just leaves, and now they hire a rookie coach who, remember, and you know, Adam Foote was a great NHL defenseman, but when he coached in the Western Hockey League, he coached Kelowna, and Kelowna was hosting the Memorial Cup that year, and he was fired in the middle of the season in the Western Hockey League. That's a red flag to me if you're moving on to the NHL. And then, you know, the mishandling of Quinn Hughes is just going to reverberate for so long. I mean, those players don't come around very often. And look what he's doing in Minnesota. Nobody's surprised by that. But and then, you know, what's the development of these pieces that they've got back? And, you know, you need good players to help young players. Do they have that? I mean, they are so far away, in my opinion. And I can't believe it's got this far. They were just, you know, deep in the second round 2 years ago. How does this happen so fast? And how are you going to rebuild it? I don't know. I mean, they will get a high draft pick, but even those high draft picks, they're going to take some time to develop, at least 3 years, and you better have people around them. So I'm completely disappointed. How's that?
Not only of Vancouver media, but I think of Canadian media, and I think of North American sports media. Jim Robson, one of a kind, and we were spoiled to hear him for so many years. Blessed.
It's a huge loss. I'll be interested to see what the Canucks do when they resume after the Olympics. I would say they're obviously going to have a moment of silence, and then a special night, maybe patches on the uniform, which I would advocate, a microphone and JR's name. I mean, they've got lots of time to think about this because they're on a big Olympic break, but let's hope they don't mess that up, because this is royalty. This is, like I said earlier, in the top five of all-time Vancouver Canuck names, and they better not mess that up. I don't think they will. They will honor him. You know they'll honor him. And I think it should go even beyond this season. If they put a patch on, for example, I would say that would be nice to see that all of next season. So anyway, my little free advice for the Vancouver Canucks. How's that?
Well, thanks very much, and hopefully they get that message.
My pleasure, Bob. Nice to talk to you again.
Same. Thank you.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Focus Taiwan.tw, Taiwan annexation by China would threaten Japan and the Philippines. If expansionist China were to take Taiwan, its neighbors would be next, warned President Lai Ching-te. During the interview, Lai said Taiwan-United States relations remain rock solid, adding that he is confident that the U.S. does not need to use Taiwan as a bargaining chip in talks with China. In ABC News Australia, man charged with stalking Israeli President Isaac Herzog during Sydney visit. Police also alleged that the 45-year-old man stopped outside a school at Bondi Junction and filmed a security guard while using offensive language. President Isaac Herzog spent 4 days in Australia, spending time in Sydney with the Jewish community to mourn and pay tribute to the 15 lives lost in the December Bondi Beach terrorist attack. In Kyoto News, Japan seizes Chinese fishing boat off Nagasaki, arrests skipper. The first time since 2022 that the agency has seized a Chinese fishing boat. According to the agency's office for the Kyushu region, the boat had a crew of 11. The skipper, a 47-year-old Chinese national, was arrested Thursday and stands accused of trying to evade an onboard inspection by a Japanese fisheries control officer about 170 kilometers southwest of the island of Meshima in Goto, Nagasaki. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, the unofficial mayor of Selwood is an elderly orange cat. Nutmeg usually arrives at the Selwood CVS early in the evening and hangs out until the store closes at 10. The cat was born under a trailer in Boone County, West Virginia, and has spent the bulk of his life in Centralia, Washington, as a mostly outdoor cat. In the Seattle Times, light rail carried over 200,000 riders on Seahawks Super Bowl parade day. Sound Transit CEO Dow Constantine called it the biggest day in our region's transit history on social media, and also said the number is likely to rise as the staff makes a more precise count. Following a trophy ceremony in front of 50,000 fans at Lumen Field, the players, coaches, staff, and family members traveled 2 miles up 4th Avenue to Seattle Center, carried in 20 military transport vehicles. The Seahawks convoy was greeted by an estimated 1 million fans. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind the headlines, such as, in the aftermath of the Tumblr Ridge Massacre, EB promises answers.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate. Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
the people of Tumblr Ridge, British Columbia, especially those who raced to help when a shooting erupted at the secondary school on February 10th.
And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to Bob at thebreaker.news.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 15th, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 15th of February in 1965, the maple leaf flag replaced the red ensign as Canada's national flag? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com.
Until next week.